So, good morning. I've just been recollecting memorable deaths, and good deaths. And then I try to recall the best death that I can remember. In fact, I wasn't present for this death, but something that I read about and has always stuck in my mind. And it was the death of the founder of one of the two founders of the monastic tradition to which I belong. And Lumpu Sao died in 1941 at the age of 80, or just over 80. And at that time, he was living in Ubon, which is about 600-700 kilometers to the northeast of here. And Ubon in 1941 was a city in small city or a town in a state of some turmoil. It was the year that French bombers dropped bombs on the city. And Lumpu Sao was bitten by hornets and fell ill as a result, and realizing that his life was probably coming to an end, he wanted to go on one last trek, one last tudong, wandering in the jungle. And so he set off to Lao with a number of his students. And during this trip, during the cold season of 1940, he fell ill, and his condition steadily worsened. And so his students were able to procure a riverboat and started to make the trip upstream along the Mekong River. And Lumpu Sao, I think, had realized he probably wasn't going to make it back to Ubon. And he suggested they make for Wat Amat in Champasak, Bakse. And the last 2 days of this journey, he was laid out, apparently unconscious, in the back of this small boat. As they, I imagine they paddled, I'm not sure whether they had an engine or a motor. But finally, they arrived at the monastery, which was right on the riverbank. And as the boat moved towards the jetty, he opened his eyes. He said, "Have we arrived?" And they said, "Yes, sir." And he got up. He pulled himself up and put on his robe. And his students, the young monks, helped him up off the riverbank and into the boat, the Uposatha hall, the main ceremonial hall of the monastery. And he called for his sanghati. For those who don't know, this is the robe. It's basically the same shape as this robe, but you'll probably see it most often when it's folded and worn over the shoulder. So we usually wear the robe in that way on ceremonial special occasions. And so he called for his sanghati, and his sanghati was draped over his shoulder. And while the monks went to bring up their belongings from the boat and to other things, he went to pay his respects to the Buddha, big Buddha statue in the ceremonial hall. And after he bowed the third time, he stayed there in that prostrate position with his forehead touching the floor, and didn't move. And his disciples, I assume, supposed that he was reciting some passage or some devotional passage, and weren't immediately aware that he wasn't moving at all. After some time, one of the monks moved closely and just very politely put his finger underneath Lumbusao's nostril, and there was no breath coming from his nostril. And he realized that the great master, who we believe to be a fully enlightened arahant, had died wearing his robes, bowing to the Buddha, and after completing his third bow. So as a Buddhist monk, this is kind of like as good as it gets. That's a best death. Now, let's fast forward many years to the, I think it would have been late 80s, early 90s. And I was on alms round in our local village. And as I, towards the end of the alms round, one of the villagers came up to me and said that one of the villagers who I knew very well and had been one of the group of lay Buddhists who had requested that Ajahn Chah allowed the Western monks or to build a monastery in the local cremation forest outside the village. So I knew this man very well and was very fond of him. So I and a couple of the other of the senior monks, we went to his house, which was just a shack, extremely poor man, living in a rather ramshackle old wooden house on stilts. And as we climbed up the stairs and went into the central area, he was laying on the floor, and he had such a radiant smile on his face, and he was so happy to see us also. And as we got closer, and he managed to lift his hands and show respects, we saw that he had a couple of very old and battered photo albums. And he showed us. And his photo albums were full of pictures of monks. And over the years, so many Western Buddhists had come to spend time in the monastery. And many of them had taken photographs of him and me and him and Ajahn Sumedho and other senior monks and him in front of this monastic building and that monastic building and outside the gate and putting food in monks' bowls. And they developed a film and given him one of the photos, and he'd made these albums. And the last days of his life, he didn't have it. He had one family member, an adopted son who nurse him. But the thing that gave him great joy was looking through this photo album. He could just spend hours and hours remembering this monk and that monk and all that. So it was clear that his mind was in a very wholesome, beautiful state by recalling the good things that he'd done in his life, the things of which he was proud, things which made him happy. And so this was, I think, the first time I really picked up on the importance of encouraging people at the end of their life to constantly, consciously cultivate memories of goodness and good deeds that they had performed during their life. And it's a thing that could, in the midst of even quite serious physical pain, and this was we're talking at a time where I don't know, he might have some Boehai or these little caffeinated aspirins or something to as the extent of his pain relief, and yet he was really radiant. The other The other occasion that comes to mind was a few years after that, and a couple who were very strong and constant supporters of our monastery had a little house out in the rice fields, and the wife had cancer and had some treatment, and it was obvious that she wasn't going to get better, and so she came back to die at home. And I would go over every day and spend some time there. And I was there right at the very end of her life. And she was laid out on the floor on a mat, and her husband, her children, and her children's parents, grandchildren, everyone was in this big room. And one person was massaging a foot, one person was holding a hand, one person had a fan and was just keeping her cool. Husband was right there on one side of her, I was on the other side giving her encouragement. And again, although she had no kind of drugs or pain relief, it was a passing which was as peaceful as you could imagine, and to see the value of having being able to pass away in your own house, in the midst of all your memories, and with your family all around you, and with your teacher, your spiritual teacher there to encourage you, that also seemed to me to be a very good death. And sometimes in speaking with the local villagers, rice farmers, and very, very poor people, I said, you know, I would say things like, you know, don't think that being rich, you know, is always such a good thing. I mean, I'll be frank, it is often a good thing. You know, let's not mince words. When you've got a lot of money, you have a lot of advantages. But one of the advantages of being poor is that you can't afford to spend the end of your life in a ICU unit in a private hospital. And there are very few rich people that can die in such a good way as all of you do. And so this wasn't just sort of trying to comfort them or, you know, look on the bright side of life kind of reflection. But I really felt that it was true. Having seen many wealthy people pass away in a very upsetting way. And, you know, I would say, in fact, that in Thailand, that we can say there are elements of popular Thai culture these days, which are regrettable, elements which are even deplorable. But there are also elements of Thai culture which are wonderful, and which I think we can often overlook. And I would say, at least in the areas of Thailand which I've spent most of my life, in the northeast of Thailand, in the villages and more backward areas, that the relationship and the way that people deal with sickness and death is probably as mature as anywhere in the world, I think. I mean, more mature than anywhere else I've seen. So, you know, we have this kind of mixture of kind of mature and immature elements in our culture, and I guess that's the same anywhere. But when I first arrived in northeast Thailand, then I found that in our monastery we had a cremation place. And part of the background for this is that forest monks, always looking for quiet places to meditate. And most villages in South Isan, anyway, they've cut down the majority of trees by the mid-70s at least. But villagers would always leave a certain amount of forest, usually about 2-3 kilometers away, maybe a little bit less, in which to cremate bodies. So the idea is that they are close enough to be able to carry the bodies, or to at least to put them on a cart and pull them to the cremation place, but far enough that you don't have to worry about the spirits. So for meditation monks, then these cremation forests, often the only forest that is left in this denuded areas, but also it's just a good distance away from the village for a daily alms round, maybe 2-3 kilometers there, 2-3 kilometers back. But also because of the belief in spirits and so on, very few people will come into the forest and disturb you when you're meditating. And so subsequently, these cremation forests have provided the place in which many monasteries have grown up, and yet retained their responsibility in providing cremations for local people. So our cremation place was just a simple brick steps coming up like this, and then on the day of a funeral, the local villagers would come in, find dead wood in the forest, pack it up between these two brick walls, and then the other flimsy flimsy wooden coffin would be placed upon the firewood, and then before the, well, let's just backtrack a little bit, if I may. After death, then the body would be kept in the house, and for maybe 3 days. Sometimes, if there were relatives working overseas, then they might keep them a little bit longer so the relatives could get back in time. 3 days, and every evening, then the monks would go into the house and chant the funeral verses, and then the senior monk, usually myself, would give a small talk and reflection on death and encouragement and support for the family of the deceased person. Then on the day of the funeral, the monks would go in again and chant, and then the coffin would be put onto a cart, and then the monks would walk carrying this long thread, pulling the cart with all the lay people walking along behind, and we'd process through the rice fields to the forest, put the coffin on the wooden pyre, and then there would be another session of chanting, something like the same kind of verses you would hear in a monastery in Bangkok, and a Dhamma talk, again reflections on impermanence and death and separation, etc. And then the funeral itself would take place. And one of the things, one of the rituals would be to place these little Dokmai Jan on the body itself. And so everybody in the village, including children, children the moment they could walk, basically, or even carried up, would climb up these little steps, look at the dead body, and place their Dokmai Jan on the person's body. So, following this, the fire would be lit, and in a very short time, the coffin would fall apart. Most of the lay people by this time would have gone home except those close family members. But the monks would stand and watch the body decompose in the fire. I thought this must be the most mature way of disposing of human body that I could imagine, and that everyone was involved. The amazing thing for me, and I've seen this over and over again in many years when we have Western visitors and young Western men coming to become monks, that people are just surprised at how light carefree even that the atmosphere is. People are laughing, joking. It's not at all the kind of atmosphere that you would expect if you come from the Western world. Some limits of decorum and very, you would, I think, be looked upon as perhaps being heartless if you were to smile or joke at a funeral in England, for instance. But I would ask, by that time I had some Thai language, and said, why is everyone so kind of happy and laughing and joking? And isn't anybody sad? And I said, well, so it's just like, it's normal, it's natural, it's what happens, you know. People get old, they get sick, they die. That's just the way things are. And so this kind of basic Buddhist wisdom is so embedded in the culture that there's this, it's not considered to be wrong or bad, or, you know, why did this happen? The only time I've seen some tears and anguish when children pass away, of course, that's something else. But for anybody, I would say over the age of 40, 50, it's just since, yeah, this is completely normal and natural. So in terms of good life and good death, from Buddhist perspective, the connection is that one part, one element of a good life is embracing the idea of death, or the reality of death, or the certainty of death. And not only that, but to recognize and to fully be conscious of the fact that this certain death is uncertain as regards to its particular nature, in terms of exactly how you would die, whether it's from an illness, an accident, or whatever, and when you will die. So the Buddha put great emphasis on the importance of making conscious to ourselves regularly, again and again, the basic facts of human existence. So it's surely not controversial that all of us one day are going to get old and sick and die. There can be no argument about this. But the willingness to allow that to nest in your mind, and to reflect on it, and to make it conscious, and not to react against it, or to repress it, or to brand it as being morbid, this is something else. And so I think we can see without too much difficulty that there are certain things that we take on as beliefs or as perceptions that we would say, yes, I agree, that's definitely true. But that we're only able to live according to those beliefs or sustain those beliefs at a time in which we don't feel emotionally threatened in some way. But that the moment that there is some strong sense of fear, anger, aversion, then often these thoughts and beliefs disappear from our mind as if we'd never heard them before. An obvious example that Buddha teaches that separation from everyone, everything that we love and cherish is inevitable. Again, this is surely not controversial. And most Buddhists, at least, will say, yes, I've heard this, and I'm aware of this. And when we see other people in a state of bereavement, or having been separated from a loved one, or had some great loss in their life, then we can even feel confident enough to give them some advice and support with these very words. And yet, when that thing happens in our own life, we find ourselves totally incapable. The words just seem meaningless. So I think the point here is that we can accept thoughts, ideas in a rather superficial way, and assume that somehow they're a part of us, but they're not. And this is somewhat of a digression. One of the great obstacles to learning, this is in education field, is what they call the fluency illusion, where you read something and you underline it and you highlight it, and then you think you can remember it, but you can't. So there are many ways in which we have a distorted idea of just how much we have absorbed of information and ideas, but particularly in what the sense that we're talking right about right now is a sense of who we are, what life is, what makes sense, all what we need to do, and it's really important fundamental issues that we only have a very superficial grasp of them, and which will disappear in this in the event of strong emotion. So the question is how to integrate this kind of wisdom in the sense of something that we've heard, which is true and useful, that we have remembered, at least in a superficial way. How can we integrate that into who we are and how we respond to situations? So many, many years ago, I had the occasion to spend some time with one of the great Thai monks of the modern era, Ajahn Buddhadasa, in south of Thailand. And I asked him, what is mindfulness? Okay. And he said, I'll say this in Thai first, okay. Sati ku banya tan. So what this means is, mindfulness means when your wisdom, when your understanding of something is right there when you need it. That's what mindfulness means. Banya tan. And so this is the importance of developing what we call mindfulness. And mindfulness these days has developed a whole kind of new life of its own, and used in a non-Buddhist context in a number of different ways. But in Buddhist context, it has a close association with memory and the ability to recollect and bring to mind what you need to know at any particular moment. And we develop this ability by cultivating this recollection of certain useful topics, and one of them is death. So the recollection of death and the inevitability of death, the uncertainty of the time of death, the uncertainty of how death may appear, this is considered part of a good life. A good life is one which encompasses the understanding, encompasses the truths of inevitable aging, the understanding that sickness and ill health is natural and normal. If we get sick and then we start to say, why me? Then the Buddhist answer would be, why not? Why do you think that you should be free of sickness? So these days, we a lot of people think, if I just eat all the right things, or I do all this exercise, then somehow you've got this kind of mystic kind of protection against death. And of more religious background, people think, oh, I've done all these good deeds, I've made all this merit, so why is this happening to me? So the idea that all goodness gives you some kind of protection against the truths of old age, sickness and death. It doesn't, but it gives you the power and the clarity of mind to be able to deal with these things better. It's not that these things don't happen. So one of the classic Buddhist blessings says, may you endure a smooth journey over the bumpy road of life. So most people who want blessings, they want blessings. May the road of my life be a smooth one. But the Buddha says, no, it's not going to be smooth, never. But you can have a smooth road over the bumps, smooth drive or a smooth journey over the bumps, if you develop yourself well. So let me sort of return briefly to the topic. So good life, this idea of good life, this does have a great deal of resonance with me personally, in that my own bumpy journey, started off as a teenager, when the question formed in my life is, in my mind was, what is a good life? Following from that, next question is, what is the best life to live as a human being? And then the doubt arises, is it even possible to distinguish between different lives and say, yeah, this kind of life or this life is better than that one? So what are your criteria for making such a judgment? You know, if we're making judgments between cars, let's say, yeah, we have all these different criteria in terms of beauty, safety, luxury, comfort, speed, etc., etc. But what are the criteria for determining, oh yeah, this is a good life, a life well led, and this was not? You know, it's so in sort of postmodern kind of idea, you don't have that kind of right to make that choice. You know, you create a narrative for yourself, and everyone has their own has the right to make their own narrative, something like this. But my question was, are there any kind of underlying universal principles? So this is what led me to spend a lot of time reading books and investigating this matter. So it became kind of all over conquering like obsession in my life, to the extent that I pretty well neglected all my school studies to pursue this. And my answers I found in book on Buddhism, and this was my path appeared before me, that most simply that human beings suffer. Some of the human suffering is inevitable and unavoidable, but a huge amount of human suffering is avoidable, and that the teachings of the Buddha provide a path of practice, a systematic and effective way to educate oneself so as to reduce and ultimately eliminate all the unavoidable suffering in life, and then to share one's understanding of how to do that with others. That for me, was the answer. The path that I embarked upon. Of course, at that time, 15 years old, I hadn't yet really formed the idea of becoming a monk in Thailand, but this was the first steps. And this idea of a good life is embodied in one of the phrases that we find in one of the very common chants, one that all of the Thai participants here will be familiar with. At the end of any ceremony, any dedication of offerings, we recite Pua Prayo Lekwam Suk Kong Kapa Jiao Tang Lai Dolot Galananta. So this is Pua Prayo for the benefit, Pua Kwam Suk for the happiness, Kong Kapa Jiao Tang Lai, so it's Kapa Jiao and everyone else, Dolot Galananta, long term. So this is our dedication as Buddhists. We're interested in creating benefit and happiness for ourselves and for others in the long term. So this is good life in Buddhism, expressed in a phrase that we're all, I think, very familiar with in Thailand. So one of the very lazy intellectual mistakes that is so common these days, even amongst otherwise quite rigorous thinkers, is to assume that there is something called religion. And you see people saying, religion is like this, and religion is like that, as if there's this one thing called religion which shares the same common properties. Now, I think that it is reasonably legitimate to apply that way of thinking to the religions that grew up in the Middle East, the monotheistic religions of Christianity, Islam, Judaism, for instance. They're one kind of family of religions. But Buddhism is of a different family of religions. And so it does not share many of the common properties of the monotheistic religions. So whereas, very simply, we could summarize, we could refer to the religions in the Middle Eastern family as essentially belief systems, and they're often referred to as faiths. I would propose that Buddhism is a different kind of religion. It is essentially an education system. So this is a radically different conception of what a religion is. A religion as a belief system and a religion as an education system. So this is very much connected with a Buddhist idea of a good life. So Buddhism considers that the human birth is a wonderful birth. It's extreme good fortune to be born as a human being. And the reason for this is our capacity for education, our capacity to learn. We can, as human beings, learn new things right till the end of our life, to the very last breath of our life. Certainly our capacity for learning shrinks as we get older, but it never disappears. And as a Buddhist, we said this is the essential feature. What is it that makes us truly human? So we have so many different answers to this question. But as a Buddhist answer is our capacity to learn. We manifest our humanity. We're most fully human in learning. And one of the words used by the Buddha to describe a fully enlightened being, what we call an arahant, is the word aseka, aseka bukon, aseka pukala. Aseka, the word a So in Pali, it's like in English, A is not, means not. And sika comes from the Pali word sikha, which is again linked to the Thai word suksa. And it means training or education. And the word aseka means someone who has no more need for education or no more need for training. So in other words, the Buddhist view is that everyone in the world, except for fully enlightened arahants, are defined by their need for education. They are, in other words, a true Buddhist is the most essential lifetime learner. So lifetime learning is sort of the essential feature of a Buddhist life, a good Buddhist life, someone who's learning. Now, what exactly, in what areas should we be learning? And in this, there are three main areas. The area of conduct, how we live in the world, how we relate to the people around us, our families, our friends, our colleagues, the community, the society we live in. Second area is the area of the heart and how we deal with positive and negative emotions. So we are all prey, naturally, to anger, greed, jealousy, anxiety, depression, etc., etc. So a good life is one which we try to educate ourselves and find a way of reducing the power of those negative emotions, ultimately letting them go. We are also, we can notice in ourselves, at least in very embryonic forms, all kinds of good qualities, with kindness, compassion, patience, contentment, peace, mindfulness. And a good life in Buddhism is one in which we learn, we educate ourselves, we find ways of cultivating those positive emotions. So reducing and eliminating negative emotions, creating and cultivating positive emotions. This is the good life at the heart. And the third area is in terms of thinking, understanding, are the way that we look at the world. And so these three areas are intimately related. This is a holistic system. But we're learning ways of solid, good, creative, critical thinking, but then particularly the Buddhist practices of particular exercises, developing discursive thought, discursive meditations, such as the recollection of death, for instance, to create particular mental states which are which have a positive salutary effect on our lives and minds. So these are the elements of the good life in Buddhism, summarized as lifetime learning, and learning in terms of cultivating and educating our conduct, our heart, and our wisdom faculty. These are the three areas, what we call the Drisikha. With this and these three areas, if we expand them into more detail, then we get the Eightfold Path, which you I'm sure you're familiar with. So the extent to which we are going to be ready for a good death is going to be quite significantly linked to the extent to which we actualize a good life. So these things are considered to be inseparable, because a good death can apply at, can appear at any time. And the Buddha would constantly be reminding monks, and we ask the monk, you know, how often do you practice mindfulness of death? Or once a day? It's not enough. How often? You ask another monk, like once every hour, not enough. Somebody else says, oh, like every few minutes. Not enough. It should be every breath. You know, that's the kind of importance given. And monks are encouraged to think every day. You know, this evening. You know, so I could be bitten by a snake. I could fall ill with malaria or this. And so rather than feeling kind of upset and insecure, if these reflections are carried on in a wise, thoughtful way, the effect is, and you can try this for yourself, is one is that you see the value of time. And we waste so much time, don't we? I mean, everyone's always, you know, everyone now, we talk about being time poor. You know, we have so little time. And yet at the same time, if you're very honest with yourself, just write out how you actually spent your time from the moment you wake up in the morning until the moment you go to sleep. How much time you spend online and on social media, you know, so... And how much, you know, of that time do you really need to spend on social media? So there are so many areas in life where we're very sloppy and heedless in our use of time. And one of the reasons for that is an absence of this sense of urgency and sense that time has, we can say, yeah, time's money, but time, you know, we don't have anything else really. And one of the ways to bring up this sense of the value of time is by reminding ourselves regularly that death can come at any time. And this is a systematic approach to bringing that more careful use of time. Another aspect of this is that we begin to see that we don't really have time for such petty emotions. How much time do we waste with loved ones just through being in a sulk or being angry or some small thing, you know, that just allow to grow until you know, you can hardly speak with each other, and so if we were beings in heaven realms, where you have like a lifetime of a million years, you know, it really wouldn't matter, would it, if you're in a sulk for a few days with somebody because of something they said or did. But we're not. We have extremely limited lifespans. And everything we have and hold is insecure. This is an insecure situation. Now, we have to come to peace with insecurity, the radical, inevitable insecurity of life as a human being, rather than try to just to forget about it. And that's the usual, that's the instinctive way of dealing with things that are threatening. But the Buddhist way is say, learn how to face these things and come to peace with them, be able to coexist with them. And this is a far more a wiser way of dealing with the truths of our existence. And so we say, yeah, I'm ready. If I live another 10 years, 10 days, 10 months, 10 days, 10 breaths, I'm ready. This is the kind of maturity that we should be seeking to develop. So as people come towards death, what are the kinds of things that prevent a peaceful death? One, the sense of things that we've done that we feel regret for, and we feel guilty about, sad about, worried about. So why wait until it's too late? Try to let go of these things. If it's anger and enmity and towards others, you know, maybe it's time to let go of that loose end and to make a fresh start, to forgive. If it's yourself, similarly. then in the case of other people, just feel this regret for all these good things that we were going to do and we never really quite got round to. Why? Because we told ourselves we didn't have enough time. So if we don't have time to do good things, then you know, what are we doing with our time? So these are two areas. Part of a good life in terms of preparation for a good death is to say, what areas of our life cause us grief, cause us anguish, cause us regret, cause us shame and guilt? What are we doing with those? Are we just turning our backs on them and trying to forget them? Is there a way of just gently bringing those things up and dealing with them in a wise way and letting go of them right now? And what are the good things that we say, yeah, one day I'll do this. One day, this would be such a good thing to do. So this is wishful thinking, is that, yeah, there will be a day someday somehow. Maybe there won't. So maybe just to give some more attention to those good things. So those are two areas. One of the key drivers of this inner training, of course, is learning to spend quality time with ourselves, rather than always looking outside of ourselves. So this is one of the ironies of the modern world. Is we've developed incredibly sophisticated means of communicating with other people. We can just pick up a phone, and I can pick up my phone and speak to my mother in England. Just like that. This is incredible. Some 100 years ago, people would have thought that was like some kind, or 200 years, like witchcraft or something like this. So we can do all these incredible things. And yet, at the same time, our ability to communicate with ourselves, to have a sense of what's going on inside of ourselves, has not developed at all. It's probably declined. And so this communication within should be, surely, one essential element of a good life. And the technique to do this, it's not difficult, but it relies on a great deal of patience and commitment. But the simple process of choosing a particular object, let's say a physical sensation, like the sensation of the breath at the nostril, and using that as an anchor. And then you keep bringing your mind back again and again. And then your mind goes crazy and it goes here and it goes there. And many people just say, I can't do this. It's too difficult. But there's the idea of I can't do it. This is wrong. But no, this is actually part of it. Because this is how you get to know what's going on in your mind and what imbalances there are in your life by stopping the mind going where it wants to and running here and running there. And you just keep bringing it back. And so you expose the power of the addiction to memory and the addiction to thought and fantasy as an escape from the present moment. We understand how greed works, how aversion works, how doubt works, how confusion works, how depression works, not through reading a textbook, but by exposing these mental states in our own minds and learning how to hold them and look at them. So it isn't the idea that meditation is you just want to get peaceful, and if you don't get peaceful, it means that you're not doing it properly or you don't have what it takes. The first stage, and it's a very important stage, is learning about all the things that prevent you from being peaceful. And you get so much really good raw data about human condition with yourself as a guinea pig. And that one of the effects of that is increased empathy. You begin to understand people around you more often through tuning in and being with these kinds of unpleasant mental states in you, and you get an idea of how to deal with them. This is your problem solving in a very profound way during this process. So this is how you you start working with the real roots of a good life or a life which is not so good, because the roots are inside of you. It's the techniques needed to make really significant progress are so simple. I mean, this is the point, that they're not complex. You are revealing complexity by confronting it with simplicity. So part of a good life is giving yourself time just to digest what's going on. And often people will, in the course of a meditation, will just suddenly, wow, how could I have been so stupid? What am I doing? Why am I holding on to this? Or why haven't I ever done that? You just suddenly, these insights arise just when you give yourself a little bit of time. And so just as if you read the lives of great scientists, often their great discoveries don't take place in the laboratory. They take place on the bus home, in the shower, when the brains are sort of full of all this information, and then they just relax, and there's this unconscious digestion and dealing with this, and then the theory comes up. But it's the same kind of thing in our lives. We're absorbing all this stuff, and all this is all going on, but we just sustain ourselves on such a superficial level that the internal digestion and processing of this doesn't go the whole way. And this is why spending time alone with yourself, meditating, is such an important part of being able to live a life which is in harmony with your ideals, and one in which you can feel a sense of, yeah, I'm happy with my life. This is a good life. But again, just to come back to this constant recollection. Yes, this is going to pass away. And one of the things in daily life is to notice the endings of things. Can you see how we focus right on the beginning of things? Something new comes up and it catches our attention. And then we allow our attention to weaken until something else appears. So we're always hooked onto the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And we do not pay sufficient attention to the passing away, passing away, passing away, passing away. But if we can redress that imbalance and bring a bit more attention to the ending of things again and again and again, then this is what prepares the mind for the increased number and more significant endings that come as we get older. In your 40s, when suddenly your eyesight starts to go, that's never going to come back. That's it. You're never going to have good eyesight ever again. And this is what happens as you get older. You get to 50 and your body is never going to be better than this, ever. And this, as you get older, more and more things. Yeah, this is how we prepare for aging. So I've gone past my time, and I could probably talk for a lot more longer. But just one last point is that, speaking about the maturity of Thai culture, and one thing that's just so wonderful and that we really need to sustain is the way that we look after our elderly in this country. I don't know, I've never seen anywhere that can match the devotion that children and grandchildren and family members, the way in which they not only their own elders but others, but in terms of preparing for death, that sense of as an elderly person, as being given that attention and care and interest and respect, that is so important, that we don't want elderly people to feel that they are no longer any use, that they're just a burden on their families and the younger ones. And we have to constantly, I've said this to people, you have to worry about being a burden, because if your children are looking after you and pushing you around in a wheelchair and helping to bathe you or massaging you or taking you out for a ride in the car or whatever they're doing, they are modeling the way that we respect and we look after our elderly. They're learning, that's their model, and that's how they look after you. And this is how we transmit these values in our society. So in Buddhism, we have this word called supara, which is, sup means good and para means burden. And so we say good burden. So we don't mind. You can be a burden. It's good to be a burden. We all want to be each other's burdens. We're not worried about that, but we want to be good burden. Don't try not to be a burden, but be a good burden. And when somebody and a monk devote, there's a little ceremony where you ask someone to be your teacher. We do this at the beginning of the rains retreat. And the Pali phrase translated is, "Dear teacher, may I be your burden, and will you be my burden?" Yeah. So this is the Buddhist approach. Like we give importance to this responsibility. We're aware of rights, we respect rights, but they have to be balanced by responsibilities. And our responsibilities to each other, in our family, and our communities. This is so important to creating a good life, which will lead to good death. So these are, if you're not so systematic, but sort of here and there. Thoughts on this topic of good life and good death, and I would like to end my talk at this point. Thank you.